It's 8:09 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, if you don't receive health care through your place of employment or as a beneficiary, then it's time once again to enroll for health insurance through the open enrollment period of the Affordable Care Act. In the studio with details, I have Beth Armstrong, Director of People's Health Clinic, and Matt Sloniker. He's with the Utah Health Policy Project. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So a year ago, we thought the ACA would have been repealed and replaced by now. Does the program look like it did a year ago after President Trump's election?
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, we have healthcare.gov. It's running as usual. We've got the same insurance options with the same tax credit subsidies available. So by and large, yes, it is the same Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, certainly the Trump administration has been criticized for shortening the length of the advertising for enrolling in ACA. But of course, if you had it, you would know to enroll. I mean, is that fair criticism? I mean, what we've heard is it has saved millions not doing that advertising.
You know, it kind of goes both ways. What we've found is that there are certain things that folks don't understand about the Affordable Care Act, and there are still millions of people that are eligible but not yet insured through healthcare.gov or the Affordable Care Act. And so what marketing does, and we were hoping for a strong marketing year, is it inform folks that there are tax credit subsidies available. That's the one piece of information a lot of folks don't understand, is that they actually get an offset to the cost of health insurance through a tax credit subsidy that makes the plans affordable. If you look at the plans without the tax credit subsidy, they don't look too affordable. So we're hoping that marketing could help educate folks.
Yeah. So maybe talk a little bit about how enrollment is done. And you've got what, between now and the end of the year to do that?
We actually have between now and December 15th. So the length of time in which you have to enroll has shortened this year. So we advise folks to do it now or tomorrow rather than next week. The process, what does it look like? You jump on healthcare.gov. You collect your payroll information. You collect any information that would help identify you as an individual. And that should be enough to get you through the process. If you need help, then we actually have navigators. Beth at People's Health Clinic has navigators at her organization, as do I and other organizations in Utah. They can help you through that process and help make sure you bring the right information and input it in the correct way and select the plan that best fits your family.
Yeah. And again, this is for anyone who may not receive it through their employment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah.
It's not just for low-income folks. It's for anybody who doesn't have health insurance.
That's right. There are a number of people out there that don't have insurance through their employer. A lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of small business people, contractors and landscapers and you name it. There are a lot of individuals that aren't offered health care and they don't receive a subsidy, but if they go on healthcare.gov, sometimes they're pleasantly surprised to see that they can get subsidized and can afford health care.
Mm-hmm. What have we seen, though, in terms of premiums? What the word I have, and it's probably just from those who have seen, the premiums are going up, and not just up a little bit, but up significantly.
You know, one of the things that we've realized this year is, yes, premiums have gone up, and premiums have really gone up since the 90s, and they've been going up at basically the same pace since 20 years ago or more. And that's not an excuse. We need to fix that. Affordable Care Act didn't cause that phenomenon, nor did it resolve that phenomenon. But what we can tell you is that the folks that came into our offices worried that they would see high premiums and have sticker shock, they've been pleasantly surprised to see that the plans are still relatively affordable. And the reason for that is the Affordable Care Act provides that tax credit subsidy. And if premiums go up, that tax credit subsidy also goes up along with those premiums to offset the increased cost. That's one of the sort of ingenious things about the ACA.
So out of pocket, it's about the same then? Is that what you're telling me?
Premiums are, mm-hmm. are about the same out of pocket, depending on which plan.
For those that receive subsidies.
Yes, right.
Now, you know that everyone that gets the ACA benefit doesn't receive a subsidy. That's only for those lower income up to 400% of the federal poverty level. So if you're over that, you will see an increase. But we've been told that those increases are not as dramatic as even private insurance increases.
So how I'm guessing when you mean private insurance, are those through the employer-based programs?
Sure. Yeah. Or anybody outside of ACA.
So it's either with your employment
right.
or ACA, no? Or other people just go out and deal with insurance companies on their own?
Yeah, there still are those options out there, the sort of off-marketplace plans that aren't through healthcare.gov. There are a few grandfathered plans still alive that provided scale-back benefits. A lot of folks wanted to keep. That was part of you. If you want to keep your plan, you can.
Right.
Those are still out there. And then there are off-marketplace plans. And we're actually telling folks, if you go on healthcare.gov and you do not receive a subsidy, it might be wise to look at off-marketplace plans. And there you might find something that's affordable, given that you don't have the subsidy anyway. The only way to get the subsidy is to go through healthcare.gov. So that's why we say go off.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. That's
good. So in terms of the premiums, I mean, are they necessary? I mean, is that – because there's no way for us to know through private health insurance companies whether or not they're making a profit or how big of a profit that they're making. So, some, you know, we kind of hear speculation that perhaps they're just, you know, kind of biding their profits, at the, you know, building up their profits, I guess, is really what I'm thinking about. Do we have any way to know?
Yeah, I mean, one way I like to determine whether or not insurance companies are doing well is just to look at their stock ticker. And stock tickers over the last 8 years have been going up year after year. So insurance companies, while they may not be making the margins on individual plans like they expected to make, for example, they may not be able to make the profits in Utah on a specific plan offered on the health insurance marketplace, overall, they're making significant amounts of money as indicated by their, you know, financial statements and their stock ticker. So and one of the reasons why premiums go up is this year, specifically to this year, is drug prices have just gone crazy. And so you're thinking about pharmaceutical companies at that point. The Hep C drug, many other drugs that have come on the marketplace are in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it's really hard for insurance plans to predict for costs like that and then help pay for those drugs when their members need them. So our health insurance system is very complicated. There are a lot of different interactions that are making it really, I think, wasteful, frankly. And the reason it costs so much is there's a lot of sort of just waste and arbitrage in the system.
All right. So what has the People's Health Clinic, Beth, seen from a year ago? Are more people using your services? So
we started the enrollment process November 1st. It'll go through December 15th. We have the navigators there twice a week. And they are busy. So it's hard. You know, I could probably get those numbers of how many they've enrolled at this same time, but I'll be able to come back and let you know at the end of the process how many we enrolled this year as opposed to last year. And again, if you're not in the ACA and want to enroll, you don't have to be one of our patients. As long as you are needing insurance, just come by, make an appointment with us, and we'll get you enrolled.
Okay, what's the number to call then?
Let's go have them call the main office desk. It's 435-333-1850.
Okay, and are these navigators there certain set times or they change?
No, they're there specific days of the week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they're there from 9 to 5.
Okay, anything else people should know?
Well, we should tell them real quick. Why don't you give a shout out to the Medicaid expansion?
Sure, yeah, I think this would be interesting for your listeners. This year, there are a number of ballot initiatives that are prospectively on the ballot. One of those is Medicaid expansion. It's a newly filed ballot initiative. And we've talked in the past about the fact we have a gap, that there are folks that really can't find any options, and they're usually of lower income. And so this would help close that gap. It would close the gap and make sure that Medicaid's available for low-income Utahns. And so in 2018 is when the vote would happen. Signatures are being gathered really soon here. That's something just to keep on your radar as you sort of, present to your listeners over the next year or so and making sure that conversation's being had. I'd love to come back and talk at length if you had time.
Okay, we'll do that. Beth and Matt, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:19. Good morning. Well, the Centerville Basin Planning Commission meeting in work session tomorrow starting at 4:30 at the Sheldon Richens Building. On the phone to preview the agenda, I have planners Ray Milliner and Jennifer Strader. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Leslie.
Okay, well, let's start with you, Ray. You're asking the Planning Commission if they will allow food trucks in the Centerville Basin. This follows some sort of recent state legislation, which did what exactly?
Well,
the legislation, basically what it did was it made it easier for food trucks to get business licenses within counties and municipalities. They required that if a food truck has a business license in another jurisdiction, that the county could not require that they get a separate business license from them, provided, you know, they basically are allowed to operate within that county without getting a business license from this county if they have one from a different place. It also eliminated some of the requirements. For example, we're not allowed to put restrictions on distances from restaurants and other things like that.
All right. So right now, food trucks are not allowed in any zone, or we have some exceptions?
We have a couple of exceptions. There's an exception in the development agreement at the Canyons and also at the Tanger Outlet. They're allowed to have a food truck there. You see it out there in the parking lot occasionally if you ever go to the outlet.
Yeah, so under this proposal, what zones then would they be allowed in?
Right now we're proposing the commercial zones, the CC, the town center, neighborhood commercial, those types of zones, like by Home Depot and the commercial center of the junction, maybe at Silver Creek by Bell, those areas that are specifically commercially zoned.
Yeah. And in Park City, they're also not allowed. Does this then change the rules for the municipalities as well?
Well, I wouldn't want to speak for Park City, but the rules that were changed by the legislature did include all, it included cities and county. So, but I did, you want to talk to the city folks specifically about what they're planning.
Okay. Talk to me a little bit about a food court, and these would also be allowed?
Yeah, the food court concept would be a conditional use that would allow for two or more trucks to be parked in a certain location. It has requirements that basically would say, okay, bring in a site plan showing the locations of the where the food trucks would be parked, picnic tables, umbrellas, garbage cleanup, all that kind of stuff. It's kind of based on ideas like if you've ever been to Food Truck Thursday at the Galvin Center in Salt Lake, or the little food truck park they have down in Holiday. Those two have been really successful, and they're just kind of ongoing themes that they have. And just every Friday or whatever, you just have the food trucks come and people gather. And it's actually in other places it's worked out really well. We thought we'd see what the Planning Commission thinks about that concept.
All right, and are we talking about possible regulations on what, say, hours that they're allowed?
You could. It's right now it's open. It's open for discussion with the Planning Commission. It could be hours. It could be days. It could be, however they choose to set it up. It could, there's lots of different ways to do it. So we want to have that discussion.
So state law allows then local entities then to allow some regulation? It's not just a free-for-all?
Yeah, it's not a free-for-all. Like, zoning still applies, but it did open things up as far as from, getting their health permit, their, food handler type permits and things like that.
Right. They would, any business food truck would still need health department approval and fire district approval as well, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Also, Ray, an amendment to the use table being requested by the Preserve Homeowner Association. They have a parcel in the rural residential zone of about 23 acres, but apparently it's improperly being used as a maintenance site for snow removal and road maintenance. So is this just another case of asking forgiveness rather than asking permission?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say that, I guess. I mean, you could characterize it that way. Basically, the preserve has all of the roads within the preserve are private, and they've been using this parcel as their maintenance facility for road maintenance and snow removal. There's been some allegations that it's been used for business uses outside of the preserve. Our enforcement team has gone in and started enforcement on them, and so their response is, well, we don't have a specific location for this. It's not allowed in the zone, and so what do we do? And so the answer was, well, your only avenue would be to change the development code to allow these uses in that zone. And so that's what they've done. They've applied for this use change in the code, and we're going to start the discussion with the Planning Commission tomorrow night to see what they think, if they think that it's fine, or if they, if the Planning Commission says, no, we don't like this, then we'll you know, the applicant or the preserve will have to find a new location.
All right. And then the former Colby School project, do we have a name for it yet, or are we just going to keep calling it the Colby School or Snowed In?
So far, it's still just been called Snowed In or Colby School.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I got on that one.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're asking the Planning Commission an either-or question. Does the Planning Commission think that the project can only develop a small hotel of 15 rooms or less, or would commissioners allow a hotel of more than 15 rooms with conditions? So why are you posing this question?
Well, the question came up at the last public hearing that we had, and the Planning Commission specifically said 15 rooms or less was the number they would accommodate. And staff's recommendation is that they go with that 15 rooms or less. The applicant is asking, they would like to ask one more time if they would accommodate it with conditions. Our recommendation is that they do it with 15.
Okay. What's the, if the Planning Commission does say only 15 rooms at most, then what's the developer's position?
Well, then the developer will need to either modify the site plan to show 15 rooms or less, or they do have the ability to appeal to the county council.
The developer wants a decision December 12th, so no more public hearings?
Oh, there'll be a public hearing on the 12th as part of that hearing.
All right. You're also asking the Planning Commission what are the impacts of the project and what do applicants have to mitigate them. What are the biggies here?
Well, the biggest impacts that we've heard from, or at least potential impacts that we've heard from the public, have been concerns about noise, concerns about special events, lighting, the size and the scale of the use. There's been a lot of concerns that the site is not large enough to accommodate the use that's proposed. And so the applicant has proposed a few pages of mitigations for the Planning Commission to review, and then we'll ask them to look at those mitigations and give us some feedback as to whether or not they're appropriate or if more mitigations are necessary.
Okay, Ray. Anything else you want to mention before I turn it over to Jennifer?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Ray. It's Ray Milliner. And Jennifer, let's bring you on. The Silver Creek Village Project and the proposal by Mountainlands Housing Trust to front-load some 283 affordable units on several parcels. It sounds like you're also giving an either-or question to the Planning Commission for this project. Do they think the affordable units are integrated throughout the project? Do we have an answer to that?
Well, I think that's the answer that we're looking for from the Planning Commission. So this project began in August. The Planning Commission reviewed a request from Mountainlands Community Housing Trust to amend the development agreement for Silver Creek, and essentially the amendment would allow them to build about 280 units on five parcels within the Village Center. And the Village Center development agreement says that the affordable units need to be generally integrated throughout the project. And so the Planning Commission reviewed it. They requested some additional information. It went back to the Planning Commission for another work session. And again, at that time, the Planning Commission still wanted some more details. Specifically, they were wanting details on who's being targeted, what are the size of the unit, what are the type of the unit. And after that meeting, the county council requested a joint meeting with the Planning Commission to discuss the public policy related to integration of affordable housing in the Village Center. That meeting was held at the beginning of October, and it was at that meeting that the county council directed the Planning Commission to review a plan that was presented by Mountainlands that identifies the parcels that are proposed for affordable housing, and then it has the associated number of units. So the most recent plan proposes that they would construct all of the affordable units, which are 330 workforce units, on about 12 parcels, and they've also included 71 market units. So the question for the Planning Commission is whether or not that meets the generally integrated that's identified in the development agreement.
Okay, and if they find that the units are not integrated, then Scott Loomis and Mountain Lands would have to amend the development approval.
Yes, then they would go through the development agreement amendment. If they do find that they meet that generally integrated, then they could move forward with just their associated subdivision plots or site plans.
Okay, Jennifer. Hey, thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Jennifer Strader with Summit County Planning Office. Joining me now on the phone with a look of what's going on in Wasatch County, I have manager Mike Davis. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, let's start with Mayflower. As KPCW has reported, two of the parcels, the Mountain and North parcel, have sold. So what does this mean for Wasatch County?
Well, on the North parcel, we have already processed an application for master plan approval. So we anticipate we'll start seeing the preliminary plat approvals come into our office. They are currently working on a plat and an alignment for the Jordanelle Parkway, which will connect roughly from where the Jordanelle Fire Station is over to the road that connects to the Browns Canyon 248 intersection. And so we anticipate within the next 2 to 3 months we'll see some activity there. On the Mountain property, the Extel Corporation, of course, as was announced, has purchased the property. We are meeting with them in probably the next week to 2 weeks, and they are going to lay out their proposed plan for development. So we don't have any details yet on what they're anticipating, but we do know that they're anticipating proceeding.
So with Extel, these meetings, are they going to be just between the staff and the owner, or are these going to be public meetings?
I think the first meetings will be staff, and then it's anticipated that they will come before the county council and show a presentation of what their overall plan is for the area, and then they will start to apply for the necessary approvals to proceed.
Okay, and I think the Mountain parcel, we're talking about 1,900, what do you call them, ERUs?
Yes, ERUs, equivalent residential units.
Okay, and one ERU is about how many square feet?
Well, it's 1,500 square feet or larger. And so anything under 1,500 square feet could be a fractional ERU, such as a small apartment or a hotel room. But anything over 1,500 square feet is one ERU.
Okay. And then the North parcel, which is the closest one to Park City, we're talking about 500 ERUs here?
I believe that's the correct number. And those are slated for the majority of which are single-family homes.
All right. And what about employee housing? Is that part of all of this?
It is. At least for the North and the Marina parcel, which isn't approved yet, there will be sections around the marina area, which is the entrance to the state park off the Mayflower exit, for affordable housing units, over 100 of them. And that also is part of the development agreement. And so all of that needs to be finalized, but will be part of the approval process.
Hmm. Is that the property that's closest to the old mine tailings?
They're fairly close to those, yes, a little bit south.
Okay. I mean, that would be the closest development, though, the employee housing to the remediated site?
No, there's other development around that as well. There's some commercial sites and some other housing sites around that property as well. We won't proceed with anything until the state gives us approval that those sites are stabilized. So we'll be waiting for that approval from the state before we allow any approval to proceed.
All right. Now, this is all being overseen by the Jordanelle's, the J-Spots, known the Jordanelle Special Area Planning Commission. Where are their meetings noticed? Are they? I don't see anything separate on the website. Is it just part of Wasatch County Planning Department?
It is part of the Planning Department. You know, I haven't looked at the notices. I think they are noticed as we notice all of our other notices. So they should be on that website and accessed through that notice process.
All right. And then any news on the MIDA deal? Has a site been selected for that MIDA hotel?
I know there are a lot of discussions with the property owners, the Extel property owners, and also the property known as Pioche that Wells Fargo owns, which is also on the west side of the highway next to Deer Crest. And I'm aware that the environmental impact statements are being worked on at this time for both of those sites. They've chosen multiple sites, and then we'll choose where they want to put the facility. The federal government can't own property until all environmental assessments are complete, and so that will have to be completed before they can own the property.
All right. Let's move to budget. You're probably in the midst of those budget meetings and a public hearing coming up next month?
Yes, that's correct. I've just finished meeting with all the department heads, and we've just gathered in all the preliminary draft budget information, and so today and tomorrow we'll put that together, and hopefully we'll have a draft budget available to the public within a week, and then it can be reviewed, and then the hearing will be on the, I believe it's the 6th of December.
All right. Can you tell me how big that budget is?
We anticipate a small increase. Most of our increased costs are in law enforcement areas. We don't seem to be able to slow that down with all the things going on. But we'll be under 10% in the overall assessment of it. I won't know the exact numbers until later today or tomorrow when we have all the figures put together. But it likely will be much less than the 10%, but I know it won't be more than that.
Yeah. So when we look at just kind of the maintenance and the operations of county government, what are we talking about, 30, 40, 50 million bucks?
Oh, no, we're less than $20 million budget for our county.
Okay, and then you would add capital cost onto that?
Any that's just for our general fund, right. Fund 10. Any capital improvement costs, big projects and so forth are put together in a separate budget, yes.
Okay. In terms of taxes needing to be raised, can New Growth handle it?
For this year, yes. We're anticipating that New Growth will handle any needs for this year. We didn't do any merit increases for wages. We will have a cost of living increase proposed that the council will have to approve. We do have some reclassifications in some areas of the county where we have to meet higher wage competition from both your direction and the Wasatch Front direction. We have to. It's hard to keep people if we don't keep the wages appropriate for those areas. So we'll have a little bit of adjusting in a couple of departments there.
Right. And what's the proposed COLA then?
3% for this year.
All right. And then the Jordan Hill Fire Department assessment expires at the end of the year, and we have already heard that a tax increase is needed there. When do those public hearings happen? At the same time as...
I believe they're the same time. I know they have them noticed. I'm not directly involved with those, but I do know that they've had the initial presentation of the proposed increase, and I believe those hearings are the same night, or at least within a day of our hearings as well.
So the county council doesn't approve that fire district increase?
They do as the governing board of the fire district. They don't do it as the council. The county council, because they are the board of the district, they do it under that authority, not as the county council authority.
All right. Real quick, the Wasatch Open Lands Board, where are we with this? Has a board been selected?
You know, I know that the county council has reached out to the other municipalities in the county and with the idea of getting participation. We've not finalized all those agreements yet, but the county is certainly proceeding forward with the concept and the proposal to look at a possible bond or a possible acquisition of property in the near future.
So their role would be to determine the priorities for open space and how much should be spent to preserve it?
Yes, and they really haven't approach that question yet. Is there are a lot of ideas out there as to what should be done. Should they bond to outright purchase property? Should they bond to purchase development rights? Should they bond to purchase to preserve existing farmland to buy those development rights? And there's a lot of ideas. Until they get the final group together. I don't think they were planning on coming up with any final things. I know they were working with the Utah Open Lands Trust people quite closely and to come up with some formalities that would allow them to come up with programs that could fit our community the best. And I don't know that they know what that is yet.
Okay.
They certainly are aware they want to do something, and so that's being pushed very hard.
All right, stay tuned then. The county council was scheduled last time we talked to get the results of a newly completed affordable housing needs assessment. Do we have the results of that then?
We're just finishing that up right now. We are working with Scott Loomis and his group. They're working on our policies and procedures to get our codes updated for the new affordable housing assessments. I would say we're within a couple of weeks. We have kind of a placeholder in place in that we have a pending ordinance, and that allows us to make some adjustments until and hold some things up until we get that final to make sure we've got everything where we want it to be for any future affordable housing needs.
Okay. Anything else going on, Mike, that you wanted to mention?
No, that's pretty much you hit the hot spots with the budget and the activity up in the Jordanelle. That's quite a bit. We anticipate seeing a lot more action in the Jordanelle now. These properties, the Mayflower properties in particular, have changed hands. And so we'll in the next year, I'm sure we'll start seeing some construction up there.
Okay, Mike, thanks for your time. Well, coming up tomorrow is the Diabetes Prevention Program and Awareness Health Fair. In the studio to tell us more about it is Serene Brooks. She's Summit County Health Department educator and a registered dietitian. Good morning, Serene.
Good morning.
So let's talk about the fair first. When, where?
Okay, so we are having a health fair. The People's Health Clinic, the Summit County Health Department, and the American Diabetes Association has teamed up together, and we're just trying to raise awareness for diabetes. And so we're going to have a health fair. It will be at the Health Department / People's Health Clinic. We share the building in our lobby tomorrow, which is World Diabetes Day, Tuesday, November 14th, and it will be from 4 till 7. And we've got a great event. We're really excited about it. We'll have people can come and have a risk test where they can answer some questions, see if they might be at risk for diabetes. We'll have A1C testing they can have done, blood glucose testing. We also have education on nutrition and physical activity and how all that plays a role in diabetes management and prevention, as well as a cooking demonstration with samples and be really fun. It's free to everyone. So
okay. And then there's a big difference, though, isn't there, between just pricking your finger to get a blood glucose reading and an A1C one? Where don't you have to actually draw blood for that?
Yeah, there is a big difference in what the test tells you. They do have a way that they can just do a small sample of blood to do an A1C now. And so when you go to the physician, they will draw blood to do the A1C, but they do have kits that we can have portable and have them there to do the A1C test. And that will tell an average over 3 months of what your blood sugars have been. So it gives you a better idea if your sugars have been high over a long period of time, where if you just prick your finger, it's just a snapshot of what you are right that minute.
Yeah. And so the cost, is it all free?
It's all free. And we hope to get lots of people there to come and learn what their risks might be or maybe how to support other people who have diabetes or know what might put them at risk in the future. Maybe even if we can just give them some resources to help them, give them a direction on where to go with where they're at.
Right. And then you also do some BMI testing. That's
yes.
Basically height versus weight.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And that just is an indicator of risk for maybe obesity, which puts you at risk for diabetes. It just kind of gives you a general guideline of where you're at.
All right. And really what we're looking for, I mean, we say diabetes, but we're talking about adult onset. Well, now it's childhood onset as well. But it's somebody who actually can make insulin, unlike a diabetic who can't.
Exactly. So there is a big difference. Type 1 diabetes is where someone cannot make insulin anymore, and that's an autoimmune disorder. And that usually manifests earlier in life. Either, you know, young children up to young adults will get type 1. This is type 2 is what we're testing or taking this risk test for the prediabetes is an indicator of the risk of getting type 2 diabetes, where the person does produce insulin, but their body just is less sensitive to it and isn't able to utilize it correctly. So their blood sugar levels can elevate. And another thing to notice, too, is prediabetes. one in three Utahns have pre-diabetes, which means their blood sugar levels are above normal but not high enough to be diagnosed as type 2 diabetes. And that's another big focus, is just helping people know. Most people don't know they have it. That's the scary part. So we're just trying to help people be aware. If they're at risk for diabetes or already have pre-diabetes, then this is the time to get help before it turns into type 2 diabetes.
Right. Once it turns to type 2, is there a way to reverse that?
Not necessarily reverse it. You can manage it and get your blood sugar levels down to a safe place, but you pretty much will manage that your whole life, where if you can prevent getting to that point and make some lifestyle changes now, if you have it, then you can prevent ever getting to that point. And another part of this health fair is helping people learn about a program that the Summit County Health Department will be starting at the first of the year, which is a diabetes prevention program for community members, where they can come and learn about making these lifestyle changes to lower their risk for getting type 2 diabetes. And it will start in January. It's a evidence-based program, and we've been offering it through other organizations for a few years now. And it's just a great opportunity for people who know they're at risk, or if you know you have prediabetes, you're one of the lucky ones that know, because there are no symptoms for it. So if you've been diagnosed with it, this is a great chance to come and learn how to make some changes to prevent getting type 2 diabetes.
Yeah. So is that how you know that you have prediabetes, is just what your blood sugar testing is, your
yes.
glucose?
Yeah.
And what's that number? I mean, is there a magic number for that?
Yeah, there is. So if you are over 5.6 to 6.5 on an A1C test, they will diagnose that as prediabetes. And it's relatively new diagnosis. They used to just tell people, oh, your sugars are a little high, and when you get to the diabetes range, will give you medication and help you make changes to manage your diabetes. Now they're realizing that if you're above normal but not quite to that diagnosis range, you can do things to prevent it. And so now it's considered a diagnosis, and it's an opportunity to make changes right then.
That can be reversed through diet
yes.
and exercise.
Yeah, and you can bring your blood sugars back down to a normal level and go for years and years without having problems. And there is a genetic component to type 2 diabetes, and there are some people who will just get it, but they still can manage it, and they can still possibly give themselves longer before they actually get it. So it's still definitely worth the effort of trying to prevent.
Yeah, what is that normal level for blood glucose?
You'd want to be below 5.6.
Okay. And then the class, this says it's starting in January. Do you have a day and time?
Yes,
this is
we're going to start in January. It'll be on Tuesdays at 5:30 for this first round. And we're hoping to offer this throughout the year at different times. It is a year-long program. However, you don't meet weekly the whole year. You meet about 24 times throughout the year. And it gives you an opportunity to get with a group of people who are dealing with the same things and same struggles. Lifestyle changes are difficult to make. And it goes through nutrition, physical activity, all the different components, emotional, sleep, stress, all the different ways to kind of deal with those barriers when you're trying to make changes. And it gives you an opportunity to meet as a group and ask. We'll have two lifestyle coaches there to run the class and facilitate the discussions and teaching. So it's a great opportunity to learn and make sustainable lifestyle changes that can last, that aren't difficult. Just changing the way you eat, your activity level, things like that, that work in your lifestyle.
So are these people who are referred to the class, or anyone can sign up?
Yeah, anyone can sign up. You need to not already have diabetes. It's really designed to prevent, but that's pretty much it. If you're at risk for type 2 diabetes as well, that the class would be good for you.
All right. And are you doing registration now?
Yes. Yep. You can go onto the Summit County Health Department's website, which is summitcountyhealth.org, and then do /diabetes-prevention. It will take you right to a page where you can click on register. If you click on that and register, it doesn't mean you're obligated to the class. That will just give me a name and number to contact so we can talk about, see if that's right for you. You can also just call the Summit County Health Department, ask about the class, and they will put you in touch with me, and we can discuss any questions you would have about it.
Okay, is there a cost to it?
There will be a cost. It's $125 for the year, but you can get back $50 for 80% attendance, and makeup sessions are optional there too for part of the class. So we've made it so that you really can pretty much get all the classes in and have it be affordable.
Okay. And really, we don't want to mess around with diabetes because it's pretty dangerous.
It is. It's really dangerous. Diabetes nearly doubles the risk for heart attack and stroke, and it's the leading cause of kidney failure. So having elevated blood sugar levels over a long period of time can cause a lot of complications in the body, and it's becoming an epidemic. And so we really want to do anything we can do to stop it.
Okay. Anything else, Serene?
Just be aware. This is the month to be aware of diabetes. If you know someone with diabetes, be aware of how you can help support them. If you know you have it, manage it. And if you think you might be at risk for it, then do something now to stop it.
Okay. Hey, Serene Brooks is with the Summit County. It's 8:52. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, in its most successful year ever, Live PC, Give PC raised more than the $2 million goal. In studio with a recap, I have the chairman of the board, Mike Rizak, along with programs director for Community Foundation, Ollie Wilder. Good morning. Congratulations,
good morning.
Guys.
Leslie.
So the final tally was what?
$2,026,917.
And that's up from $1.7 million the year before. So another really surprising leap forward.
Yeah. How many unique donors, and how does that compare with prior years?
We had a little over 4,100 donors, which is about a 12% bump up from last year, which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
Right. Yeah. That was something that we were encouraged by all day. We saw that the number of donors was trending ahead a little bit all day, and it ended up really quite a bit ahead. So we've jumped from 3,600 last year to 4,100 this year donors. I mean, it just reminds you that people are just more and more people are coming to the table to support these nonprofits.
Yeah. So how much of that amount was matching grants? I mean, those are all included here, right?
Right. So the total in matching grants that were made available for the day that actually were matched was $373,000. And then there were other offline gifts, meaning checks and things like that, of over $700,000. And the online giving was a little over $900,000. So it's interesting to think that the online giving represents actually a little less than half of the total given, but it's still a really fun online day. And those offline gifts tend to be a lot bigger. They tend to be, you know, anything above $1,000, often a $10,000 gift will come in that way. And people are making those through, say, donor advised funds or other means that aren't as easy to do online.
Sure. And there's also, I mean, the fee that is charged by Razoo. So it maybe makes more sense to give those big gifts, right, to get all of the money to the organization. Sure.
We saw some people donating appreciated stock to their organizations or whatnot, too. So there's many different ways to skin a cat, so to speak.
Well, now, how did the Community Foundation do? Because you were out there looking for contributions as well.
We did really well. For our unrestricted funds, I think we raised somewhere over $90,000, which is really nice. To be honest, I think Mountain Trails and a couple of the others actually beat us. If you look at the leaderboard listings, you only see online gifts, and it doesn't look like quite that much. But if you go to their actual page, they include the offline gifts that they reported. And I believe I saw Mountain Trails up over 100,000. So there are organizations that really are doing a great job at bringing the community together on this day. And it makes a huge difference to what they can do in the year.
Yeah. So, is this staged so that we kind of to keep that momentum going, and then some of these gifts, offline gifts, come in later in the night?
There's a little bit of discretion as to when some of the offline gifts come in, but actually late in the evening, there were several pretty substantial offline gifts that were reported by the nonprofits to us, and we pushed those right on through to make sure that they'd appear on the leaderboard.
And it was not staged. That was true drama.
Yeah, that we were nervous toward the end there. We did not really think we were going to make it.
Right. Okay, because that's not what I'm kind of hearing. I'm kind of hearing that it's like they know. I mean, because they don't want it right. They don't want to wreck the suspense. But
well, if you think about last year, we hit our mark at about, what, 10 o'clock? Maybe?
Yeah, a little bit earlier in the night. And we had a sense before that it was looking good. This year, we didn't actually have that sense. This year, moving into it, we were thinking, well, it's looking good to beat last year's 1.7 million, but we're not quite sure that we're going to hit that 2 million mark. We really weren't sure until about 11:20 when, you know, some really substantial gifts were reported.
All right. And then tell us that was neck and neck all day long between KPCW and Mountain Town Music.
It was. So let's start first with the overall leaderboard, just to give credit where credit's due. So sponsored by Park City Mountain and Epic Promise, Mountain Trails Foundation won first place based on number of donors. Park City Education Foundation for the first time is on this board in second place, and Summit Land Conservancy in third place. So they won $2,500, $1,500, and $1,250 in prizes. But then we had a bunch of themed leaderboards. And on the Energizing and Enlivening leaderboard, which is basically arts and culture, yes, you're right, KPCW and Mountain Town Music tied with exactly 266 donors each. And then Park City Film Series came in third in that category. Because you guys tied, we're giving both organizations the first prize of $1,250 each. So that was something that we had to dig a little deeper to make that possible, because normally it would be $1,250, $750, and $500 for the themed leaderboards. But in this case, it just seemed right to, you know, make good on that.
And that's all you were comparing then, was the number of donors, because it looked like when you went into the pages themselves that Mountain Town did a little bit better financially.
It's actually the number of online donors. And the total amounts, you know, it would be too easy for a donor to just make a big fat donation if it was only money-based and just skew the whole thing. But it takes work to rally those people.
Sure. So what do you guys do for next year? I've even thought about it.
That's a good question.
You know, next year, I think the date will be November 9th, Friday, November 9th. That would be the time to do it. We haven't fully confirmed, but let's put that out there. As far as the amounts go, it's a good question. You know, what the thing that probably we feel most strongly about is more people, and that keeps happening. The 4,000 donors this year was so inspiring. So, you know, one option is for us to focus even more on just rallying the community.
Right, maybe going for 4,500 donors and not caring so much about the amount? Or?
Right, maybe changing the metric or changing what success means. But either way, whether we raised 1.7 million or 2 million for this community, that's still a heck of a lot of money for one day, and it goes a long way, so...
Yeah, pretty amazing. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Just if people want to check out the results, they can still go to livepcgivepc.org. There's a survey on there if you scroll down a little bit to where you can give feedback. And we just want to thank the community for once again rising to the occasion and just acknowledging the amazing work nonprofits do. And that's only possible because of all these people who give to put the support behind it where it needs to be.
Okay. Hey, Ollie, Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.